ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Media Land on ABC Radio National, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows in stormy northern Tasmania.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
This week, Mark Humphreys helps us track down what makes Australian media moguls so addictive for audiences.
A media boss declares war over proposed copyright law changes.
And the Google AI machine spreads its tentacles even further. News Corp Australia boss Michael Miller fired some more shots at the big media companies this Wednesday at the Melbourne Press Club.
Today I want to talk about the price Australians are being asked to pay by the latest tech revolution. We are arguably being asked to surrender our stories, our voice, our culture, our identity, and ultimately our Australianness. This struggle is all too familiar to those of us here today, because you have each gone through it at least once already. You have lived it, been disrupted, and at times been overwhelmed by it. I do call it the big steal. We all lived through the first big steal, when our ideas, work, and creative content was hoovered up by the internet. And now there are those of us who expect to stand aside and let it happen all over again. We must not.
You can tell that they're at the Melbourne Press Club there, Tim, with the clattering of knives and forks. But that was...
There's some hard dining going on.
That was the executive chairman of News Corp, Michael Miller, starting what was a 22-minute, I don't know if we'll call it a tirade, against the dangers of changing copyright law in Australia.
Well, he speaks in such a mild way. I don't think he's ever actually delivered a tirade himself. But the, you know, the words were pretty strong and clearly intended to be a bit of a kind of unifying call to local media players in Australia to sort of stand together against the platforms and the rise of AI. And I think the most sort of central point was reacting to this proposal of a few weeks back from, well, being championed by the Tech Council of Australia. You might remember Scott Farquhar, one of the founders of Atlassian, who's the chair of the Tech Council, was arguing for this new exemption to copyright law. So to allow for what they call TDM, text and data mining. So effectively saying, let's loosen Australia's copyright law so that the AI businesses can use this Australian content more easily.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating with these media companies who are both railing against AI and using AI within their own businesses. It's such a delicate dance that they're doing, where I think audiences are getting a bit frustrated by some of the AI tools that media companies are using, which some people see as making the content a lower quality. And then on the flip side, you have executives taking to the Melbourne Press Council saying, we need to try and put this genie back in the bottle. All the while, the tech companies are kind of, I mean, we're talking about the legalities of what they're doing and whether or not we relax these laws, but aren't they already taking the content, Tim? Like, haven't they already taken it? It's too late.
That is definitely one of the issues, you know, and there have been a number of libraries of book content, for instance, which were illegally kind of lifted and then, as court cases then kind of revealed, were used to train, for instance, Meta's AI, which is still an ongoing or potentially going to be another legal case. Now, one difference is in the US, the version of copyright usage is something called fair use, whereas here in Australia, we have fair dealing. And the idea being that there are certain ways you can talk about things, you can use things. One of them is talking about for a news event, another is for the purpose of satire. But effectively, it means you can't just help yourself to content unless you have permission or some form of licensing. And this is the form of or the central point where Australia's media companies, I think global media companies, are falling out with the AI companies. Is they're sort of saying, well, it's not particularly fair for you to help yourself. If this is valuable stuff, then if we don't get paid for it, then who's going to create the valuable stuff next time around?
Yeah, the creation of new stuff, I think, is a really interesting point here, because essentially all of these language models and AI bots and summaries that you see, it's all based on old content. It's not actually creating anything new. Even the daughter of the late American actor and comedian Robin Williams, Zelda Williams, hit out at AI for this very reason this week. You know, she said, for the love of everything, stop calling it the future. AI is just badly recycling and regurgitating the past to be reconsumed. You are taking in the human centipede of content, and from the very, very, very end of the line, all while the folks at the front laugh and laugh, consume and consume. So, I mean, that's more of a tirade than what Michael Miller from News Corp was doing. But it does feel like people are really starting to argue about stealing this old content and what happens to new content.
I had not expected us to talk about the human centipede today, Viv.
I'll always find a way of working it into the conversation, Tim.
On Wednesday, Google launched into Australia a chatbot-like advanced form of AI search called AI Mode. Now, some are calling that a move from search engine to answer engine. And Viv, I must admit, I don't know if I'm the very last user in Australia, but every time I try to use it, I get a message saying, this is not available to you yet. So although I've read much of it and seen screenshots, I haven't had an opportunity to play with it myself. But in essence, where it changes from the old experience of searching was Google would sort of give you an answer and then a link to go off somewhere to find out more. Now it gives you everything on the page.
Yeah, the idea of an answer engine is really interesting, because I also keep hearing things about us being in the answer economy now. It feels like we've had a bit of a change in the language we're using around these tools. And I do wonder if that, whenever the language shifts, it almost happens after the change has already occurred. But we were talking before about Michael Miller and railing against these AI platforms. This is another tool that will presumably have huge implications for news outlets, because if they're no longer leading you to leave the Google ecosystem and go and click to read more, news publishers are surely going to see a huge drop in traffic, because people won't search further than their quote-unquote answer engine.
Yeah, look, that's looking likely. And I think if there was one thing that I sort of, you know, perhaps took issue with in Michael Miller's kind of summary of the previous situation, was in that first wave, yes, Google did start tracking, you know, every single story in the world, but there was a kind of deal in place where publishers, at the very least, got traffic, which they were then able to serve ads up against, which was how they made money. The difference this time around is there's no similar sort of grand bargain, because what happens now is, you know, Google's not alone, but Google and a lot of the AI services, they get that information, they take it from these publications, and then they serve it up right there on the page. So there's no way for the publishers, or no obvious way for the publishers, to make money from the content they've created. And if that creates a risk for, you know, the content we like to see, then it's, what's the incentive for people to create more content like that if they can't make money from it?
One frustration I've heard from some people with these Google AI summaries is that sometimes the AI misinterprets the information and serves up an answer that's incorrect. If people aren't clicking through anymore to then realize the discrepancy in the summary they've read, I fear we're going to end up in even more of a sort of misinformation society, because you'll read the summary, it's wrong. There'll never be a correction issued. And even if there was, you won't see it.
Hey, at some point I read on a ChatGPT, which is a service from OpenAI, that I have a degree in media from Birmingham University in the UK. Given that I did not even go to university, that was wrong in a number of details. But you're right, if there's no link to click and find out more, then what happens? And this is the sort of real kind of inflection point that we seem to be hitting, is it feels like that moment of zero click is upon us. You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
If you weren't reading the newspapers in Victoria and Queensland in the 1980s, then you could be forgiven for not knowing the name of fallen media mogul Christopher Skase.
A problem Mark Humphreys is solving with a new podcast from ABC Radio National, Rewind, Skase, Fall of a Tycoon.
This is the story of one of Australia's most successful businessmen. It's also the story of one of Australia's most loathed fugitives. This is the story of Christopher Skase.
Christopher Skase was charming,
audacious,
powerfully charismatic,
a hustler and a huckster.
Christopher Skase was the man of corporate Australia in the 1980s.
Skase had an aura of success.
He came with that cowboy energy.
He built a vast business empire.
I used to call Christopher God. He was very clever at motivating people to do things that he wanted done.
And with his wife Pixie by his side, he charmed the country.
They were the story of Australia.
Mark joins us now to talk media moguls. Mark Humphreys, welcome to Medialand.
Oh, lovely to know that I'm a problem solver. Thank you for that.
Who was Christopher Skase? Should we be thinking of him as Australia's forgotten media mogul?
I think people who lost money to him certainly haven't forgotten him. I mean, I think he's such an interesting character because, you know, someone like a Rupert Murdoch, his business interests have primarily been media. But with Skase, you know, he owned Channel 7, but then he also owned a footy club and he also developed resorts in Queensland. So it's not just one area. He was sort of spread out and part of his downfall ultimately was he wanted to move into Hollywood and wanted to buy MGM United Artists. And he put in this crazy, basically $2 billion bid for the studio when he didn't have the money. But
that was the James Bond studio.
That's exactly right. James Bond, Rocky. And yeah, this was a mogul, not just in the media, but across multiple industries.
And why was he seen as such a character, Mark? Even when you arrived in the studio today, we were joking about his hair and just the whole sort of 1980s vibe of it all.
100%, totally. I mean, yes, there was the whole aesthetic. There was a look to it. And he also had his wife, Pixie. I mean, even just the name Pixie Skase is sort of evocative. You know, she had big hair and they had the shoulder pads and he'd be wearing these, you know, white suits. And so it was it was the image of success that they were projecting. And I think that's part of the undoing or part of how you see people got sort of sucked into this is that the image was so clearly, oh, these people are doing very, very well. I should get on board with that. And not realizing that actually this is a house of cards, an empire built on debt.
Aside from his career in front of the camera when the authorities were trying to chase him down and get that debt back, what was his life behind the scenes in terms of owning media in Australia and dictating the sorts of stories that Australians might be seeing or hearing?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, oh gosh, I don't know if I can really speak to that element. I mean, in terms of him running Channel 7, you know, I know he brought Darren Hinch over to 7, who at that point I think was more of a radio presenter. But that's interesting. I don't know. I don't get the sense, not like with a Murdoch where you get the sense that there's very much a slant or there's a worldview that is trying to be pushed. That's not something that we've really come across so much in this case. I mean, it was under Skase that Home and Away... So you can look at something else. If you don't like Home and Away, that's something else you can blame Skase for.
Well, you mentioned Darren Hinch, and what really struck me in that episode was, well, A, how wealthy he made Darren Hinch with the big bid, but it really reminded me of the way that when John Singleton rebooted 2GB as a talk station and bought Alan Jones across for a lot of money, it does feel that sometimes there's just a very small number of media personalities that when they team up with a media tycoon, they can sort of change the game a little bit.
Oh, that's interesting. I think with Hinch, I get the sense that maybe, unfortunately for Darren, he received a lot of his pay in shares, which ultimately...
Yes, they weren't worth as much at the end of the game,
so,
were they?
Hopefully he cashed out at the right time. I'm not sure.
Do you think there is still lingering anger in the community towards Skase? Have people moved on, or is this a story that is still very much playing out for some people.
Yeah, I think I suspect broadly the country has moved on because, you know, he died, what was it, 24 years ago. But if you were, I'm certainly aware of people who, yes, were genuinely affected, who, you know, businesses that were destroyed by it, people who lost superannuation, you know, mum and dad investors, all those sorts of stories. So, yes, there's absolutely people out there who would still, I think, you know, spit in response to hearing his name. But as a country, I think, yes, now enough time has passed for us to kind of collectively go, okay, what was going on here?
You spoke to a lot of journalists who worked with or for Skase. I'm always fascinated by characters like this, and I always wonder, do they know they're lying, or do they really start to believe their own bullshit, for want of a better word?
That's a great question. That's fascinating. There's an interview, we play part of an interview where John Laws went over to Mallorca to speak to Skase. And Laws conducts a fantastic interview, to his credit. But Skase is just talking absolute nonsense, but with great self-belief, sincerity. It's a wonderful question. I don't know to what extent he believed it or not.
It made me think a bit of the story of Robert Maxwell, just listening to some of the episodes you've done, just sort of who was this sort of giant tycoon who in that case was appropriating the pension funds of staff, so doing all these highly illegal things to keep the to keep things spinning, to keep the plates spinning, you know. So, and that felt like very much the story of the whole Skase empire. It was always trying to raise funds for the next thing, and obviously that included those big investments in Port Douglas.
Yes, and so borrowing upon, you know, borrowing to pay off the other borrowing, and then, you know, of course, when interest rates go up, then you're really in trouble.
We've spoken about people in the community who are still frustrated by Skase, and journos who've worked with him. Was there a natural suspicion around Skase? We also spoke about, you know, his whole 80s very aesthetic, looking a certain way. Did that scream crook to people, or was it? Was the vibe like, oh, this guy is really like an entrepreneur?
That's such a great question. The sense I get is no, it didn't raise red flags. And I think what's funny as well is that there are clues in plain sight. The fact that the resorts are called Mirage, I think, is one clue. And the ads for the Mirage, the song, there was a song, there were these commercials that would go, too good to be true, Mirage. It was too good to be true. Like he was telling you. Exactly right. But I do think that people, got sucked in. I don't get the sense that it wasn't until, you know, people who were working within Quintex and you know, we're talking about accountants and people that are having to actually go through the books. That's only where it starts to become apparent how, you know, fragile this enterprise really is. No, I don't get the sense that there were people out there going, this guy's full of it.
And in terms of his media profile, something I sometimes find as a journalist is, it is possible to be seduced by the big characters because they're just there is a risk for a journalist that you end up putting things through the lens of they're a really interesting person who's going to be interesting for my audience. And sometimes that sort of skepticism can be left at the door a little bit just because they're so fascinating.
Yeah, well, this is one thing that I must admit I have struggled to make sense of, because the people that we've spoken to do talk about being sucked in by his sort of aura, some sort of, I hesitate to use the word charisma, because when you listen to him and when you see him interviewed, I find him so unimpressive. I don't see, you know, like, as much as I loathe Donald Trump, I can see that there is, you know, he's a character, there's a persona. I can sort of get it. But Skase to me is so understated and unremarkable that I'm sort of baffled by it. But I think Darren Hinch even says that, I think that you know, at a dinner, you'd be lucky to get, you know, you'd be sitting next to Skase and you'd be lucky to get 10 words out of him. So, I mean, he must have had something, but whatever it was is not apparent to me.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National with Tim Burrows and me, Vivian Kelly. We're talking to comedian and radio and podcast host Mark Humphreys about his new ABC podcast series, Skase, Fall of a Tycoon. Mark, you just mentioned that at a dinner party, you'd only get 10 words out of Christopher Skase. So firstly, I'm glad we've got you here, not Christopher. But then why was he so compelling then if he couldn't even tell a good story or charm people? How does he have such a legacy of swindling people? And
I think it is the lavish lifestyle. I think it's some of these parties where, I think it was one where it cost $400,000, and I'm talking in, you know, late 1980s money, and celebrities would be flown in, the cast of MASH, you know, Loretta Hot Lips Sweat would come in, George Hamilton with his incredible tan, and I think it's just everything around it that I can totally see how you would be sucked in by it, even if the man. And that's the other thing. Sometimes people who are, you know, men of few words, can be weirdly, that's some part of their enigma. You know, they're enigmatic. That's some sort of weird appeal. That's just like, oh, there's something mysterious about this person. Maybe they're just dull, but maybe they're mysterious.
So why do we find media tycoons so fascinating then? I mean, in recent weeks, we've all been talking about Lachlan and Rupert Murdoch and the succession dramas there. What is it about those stories that keep us hooked?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I guess the power. That's sort of extraordinary power to be able to control a message and to have your worldview sort of be disseminated on a massive scale. And as I say, I don't get the sense that Skase did that to the extent that, you know, the Murdochs have. But I think that's certainly a fascinating idea to have such a loud trumpet, I suppose.
I'm interested to talk a little bit about your own journey within media, because you obviously you're well known to ABC listeners, but you've also worked within commercial media as well, including for Seven more than once. I guess it's become almost a cliche now, but you feel like the classic portfolio career has. Is that the plan, or is that just how it's unfolded?
It's just how it's unfolded. I mean, in terms of entering into comedy, my ambition was always to write sitcoms. That was what I thought I wanted to do. What ended up sort of happening is that my first comedy gig was on a show called The Roast, which was one of those shows that the ABC does every few years where they bring in a bunch of young people who don't know anything and let them just go and make something for a couple of years. And those shows are so important. And so, you know, before The Roast, there'd been Hungry Beast. After The Roast, there was things like Tonightly, SBS, where I also worked, had the feed. Right now, there's basically nothing. And I cannot stress enough how important those shows are. It is so valuable to have shows where people, young people, can get it wrong and really, there'll be terrible episodes and, you know, some questionable choices. But out of that, you know, you look at something like Hungry Beast, and I was an intern on that.
This was Andrew Denton's project.
Exactly right. And so, and Denton is actually, you know, a big part of the Skase story as well. He was hiring a bounty hunter attempting to hire a bounty hunter to track Skase down, bring him back to justice. But yes, so Denton had this produced this show for 3 years on the ABC, which, you know, gave us Mark Fennell and Dan Illich and Veronica Milsom and Lewis Hobber and people like Kirk Docker, who've gone on to create things like You Can't Ask That, and the new show and the second series of I was actually there. There's just an incredible legacy that comes out of these experiments. And I've strayed from your original question, but I do just want to say those shows are important. Please do more of them.
Well, I feel like I ask this question every week, Mark, but do you think that the Australian media is now more risk-averse to doing shows like that?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at how much, obviously I'm looking at things from a comedy standpoint especially. I mean, how many sitcoms are there on the commercial networks? You know, like when have 7, 9 or 10 made a sitcom? You know, they might do one every 3-4 years. And if it doesn't work, there's so much pressure on them as well. There's no room for failure. It's sort of, if something doesn't work, If a sitcom doesn't work, then the attitude doesn't sort of become, well, that didn't work, we'll try something else. It becomes, no, that whole genre doesn't work. We're not even going to attempt anything in that sphere anymore. And then the ABC has its limitations. And so luckily, ABC still does put sitcoms out there. But really, in terms of what they can realistically put out there, we're talking maybe two or three shows a year. You know, we'll have a Fisk, we'll have a Mother and Son. That's really kind of the extent. Austin, you know, there's not a huge amount that can be done, and it's too much pressure for one network to be single-handedly trying to prop up, you know, the entire comedy industry.
I'm conscious though that you are very good at manifesting these things. So you've been talking about how interested you are in the writing of sitcoms. I remember, I think you tweeted about how much you liked Pointless, and then you ended up as the host.
That's right. Yeah, I was a huge fan of the British version of Pointless. And I tweeted, if they ever make an Australian version of Pointless, I'd love to host it. And then fast forward, I don't think maybe 3 years, and Channel 10 announced that they were making an Australian version of Pointless. And I, you know, half jokingly quote tweeted myself back when that was a thing that you would do, and said, you know, offer still stands at Channel 10 at Endemol Shine AU. I looked up which the production company was. And within a week, I was at SBS and I got a phone call from David McDonald at Endemol Shine saying, I've got this tweet here saying that you're interested in hosting Pointless. Are you serious or were you being satirical? I was like, oh, I'm deadly serious. And so, yeah, and that was just, you know, obviously it didn't, you know, pan out. You know, didn't go on to become a long-running thing. But it was an incredible experience to even just to audition for it. And I think maybe part of the reason I ended up getting the role was that I was so relaxed in the audition because I knew I wouldn't get it. Who was I? I was just some guy making little sketches over at SBS. And but I think that probably, yeah, played to my benefit.
So, Mark, you've made Skase Fall of a Tycoon. If you could manifest your next project now here on ABC Radio National's Media Land instead of on Twitter or X, what would it be?
I would like to host the Logies one day.
Well, you heard it here first. Mark Humphreys to host the Logies. Thank you so much for joining us on Media Land, Mark.
Thank you, gang. This has been fun.
Alrighty, Viv, what's the marvellous world of media been delivering to you as a consumer this week?
Well, I have been reading a book called The Worst Thing I've Ever Done, which is a fiction book by Claire Stevens, who used to be one of the editors at Mamma Mia and hosts a bunch of podcasts and does a lot of writing as well on Substack now. It's a fictional account of a woman who works at a women's media company and writes an article that gets her quote unquote cancelled by an influencer who goes online and starts calling her out for all of these things. I was definitely nervous going into the book in case it was a bit of a get out of jail free card for any women in media who might have said problematic things and sort of trying to do, you know, what about the other side? But so far, it's actually really surprising and it's a situation I was not expecting and I have no idea how it's going to end.
Well, great recommendation. Remind me of the name of the book.
It's called The Worst Thing I've Ever Done.
Well, remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And who's your favourite media tycoon? We would love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Rob Kelly. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on ABC Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.